ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Welcome to the reading of Sri Ramayan, the story of Lord Ramachandra, rendered into English by His Holiness Bhaktivikas Swami in this beautiful edition. And we're very excited to be reading the direct pastimes of the Lord and to be joining together with all of you to do so. This is the greatest happiness, pleasure in life, and it brings complete success for those who speak, for those who listen, and everybody in between. So we'll be completing the entire book, summary of the Ramayan, starting tonight and then going through the weekend. So you can tune in through the ISV channel because we have it all chalked out, a marathon reading. And you might as well cancel all your appointments and tell everybody that you can't come wherever it is because you have to listen to the Ramayan. In fact, the whole city should sit down here in Silicon Valley and everyone should stay home and listen. I'm saying everybody, including all the CEOs and everybody else. So we begin tonight in this beautiful edition of the Ramayan in the Balakanda. And this is starting in the book, if you're following along, on page number one. Once, in a time long ago, there lived a great sage named Valmiki, who was never so happy as when he was discussing the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One day, while Valmiki was explaining the nectar of Krishna consciousness to a group of disciples, the great sage Sri Narada Muni, who travels continuously throughout the spiritual and material worlds glorifying the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appeared at Valmiki's hermitage. Upon seeing Sri Narada, Valmiki and his disciples immediately offered their respectful obeisances. Then, according to custom, they offered Sri Narada an elevated sitting place and washed his feet, while sweetly inquiring about his welfare. After this, Valmiki inquired from Sri Narada, "O best of all knowers of truth, please tell me who, present now on earth, is a reservoir of all opulences in full? Who is the most accomplished, learned, powerful, noble-minded, truthful, and grateful? Who possesses flawless character and remains engaged looking after the genuine welfare of all living entities? Who is there present that is without an equal, clever, the most beautiful, and is never subject to the influence of anger or malice, yet instills fear within the hearts of even the great demigods when enraged? Who has the prowess to give protection to everyone within the three worlds? To whom has the goddess of fortune bestowed all blessings? O great sage, please answer my inquiries fully." The great sage Narada, who is able to know everything that happens within the three worlds, replied, "O Rishi, there is an illustrious king by the name of Ram who has appeared in the royal dynasty of Ikshvaku as the son of Maharaj Dasarath. He is the embodiment of all transcendental qualities and the possessor of all opulences. Ram perfectly controls his senses and is the master of unlimited potencies. Ram has mighty arms that extend down to his knees, and his throat is marked with three auspicious lines like those on a canticle. He has high and broad shoulders, a wide chest, a beautifully formed head, a graceful forehead, powerful jaws, and deeply embedded collarbones. His eyes are large. He is majestically medium tall in stature, and all his limbs are well formed and symmetrical. His bodily complexion is dark greenish-blue and has a great luster. His intelligence is unfathomable. His manner is grave, and his speech is superb in tone and eloquence. Lord Ram has a supremely pure character and is a follower of true religious principles. He is full in self-realization and is the upholder of Varnashram Dharma. Truly, he is the support of the entire universe. He is simultaneously the destroyer of all foes and the only shelter for those who are fully surrendered. Lord Ram is the absolute knower of the Vedas. Furthermore, he is fully conversant with the use of all weapons. He possesses unflinching determination and is ingenious with unfailing memory. Indeed, his learning is without bounds. He is wise, compassionate, and heroic in battle. He is loved by all creatures and is impartial toward friends and foes alike. He is grave like an ocean. In fortitude, he is like the Himalayan mountains. In strength, he is like Lord Vishnu. In beauty, he is like the moon. In forbearance, he is like the earth. And in anger, he is like the fire that blazes forth at the time of universal destruction. In wealth, he is like Kuvera, and in devotion, he is like Dharma, the Lord of Righteousness. Narada then briefly described to Valmiki the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. He concluded by telling him that this same Lord Ram now rules over his subjects in a most righteous and exemplary manner. He explained that during the reign of Lord Ram, no one would suffer from any disease or mental disturbance. Everyone within Lord Ram's kingdom would be happy and prosperous, never fearing thieves, scarcity, or hunger. All the cities and villages would be filled with abundant grains, fruits, vegetables, and milk products. Indeed, the people would experience the same degree of piety and happiness that was exhibited during the Satya Yuga. There would be no natural disturbances like floods, earthquakes, or famine, and all the women would be chaste and never suffer widowhood. Lord Ramachandra would rule over the earth in this way for 11,000 years before returning to his supreme abode in the spiritual sky, Vaikuntha. After satisfying the inquiry of Valmiki Muni, which was for the benefit of the three worlds, Sri Narada again took up his travels, spreading the glories of the Supreme Lord. The sage Valmiki then journeyed to the banks of the river Tamasa, accompanied by his disciple Bhardwaj. At the riverbank, Valmiki sat down to meditate upon the words of Sri Narada. Sitting within the forest, Valmiki happened to see a pair of cranes fully absorbed in sexual intercourse and singing in melodious jubilation. At that time, a malicious hunter of the Nishada race appeared from his hiding place and released an arrow that pierced the body of the male bird, causing it to fall, shrieking to the ground. Then upon seeing her mate writhing upon the ground and smeared with blood, the she-bird cried out in terror, having suddenly been cast down from the heights of sensual pleasure to the depths of despair. When Valmiki witnessed this tragic scene, feelings of great compassion welled up within his breast. Considering the Nishada's violent act to be extremely sinful, Valmiki became angry and cursed the hunter, saying, "O killer of birds, as punishment for your heartless murder of an innocent creature engaged in gratifying his mate, may you never find peace of mind for endless years." However, no sooner was this curse uttered than Valmiki felt a pang of shame for becoming a victim of uncontrolled anger. Indeed, as an enlightened soul, he knew that all living beings are acting helplessly under the influence of material nature. Thus, he regretted retaliating against the hunter. At the same time, Valmiki was astonished that the curse he uttered had come from his mouth in a wonderfully poetic meter. Indeed, his curse seemed to hint of the predominant emotional expression of the Ramayana, which he had been contemplating since his meeting with Sri Narada. This caused Valmiki to remark to his disciple Bhardwaj, "From my sorrow came a verse of four lines, each containing eight syllables. From shoka, lamentation, has come a wonderful shloka verse. For without compassion, there is no possibility of genuine poetic expression." Thereafter, Valmiki bathed in the river Tamasa and returned to his ashrama with Bhardwaj, while continuing to meditate upon his curse of the hunter. He suddenly saw Lord Brahma descending from his abode, the topmost planet within the universe. Overwhelmed with wonder and jubilation, the speechless Valmiki stood up to receive the firstborn within the universe. When Lord Brahma appeared before him, Valmiki offered his respectful obeisances and worshipped Lord Brahma with great awe and reverence. Then Lord Brahma, the universal grandsire, who can understand the hearts of everyone, said, "O blessed sage, please do not grieve by thinking you have wrongly cursed an Ishada hunter. In truth, the words that you have appeared to utter in anger were my own. They were spoken through your mouth for the purpose of inspiring you to accomplish a great task. Indeed, the time has come for you to compose the history of Lord Ramachandra's life, great transcendental pastimes meant for the ultimate welfare of the world." My dear Valmiki, there is no cause for you to be anxious, for by the strength of my benediction, everything that is unknown to you will become clearly revealed within your heart. Thus, by my grace, your narration of the Ramayana will be faultless. After bestowing this benediction upon Valmiki, Lord Brahma departed for his abode upon his celestial swan carrier, filling all who beheld him with wonder. Valmiki then sat down in meditation to discover all the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra as indicated by Lord Brahma. Absorbed in a deep trance, Valmiki clearly envisioned within his heart all the events of Lord Rama's appearance. Valmiki then composed the Ramayana in 24,000 verses. After completing the epic poem, he wondered whom he could teach it to so that it would remain preserved in memory and propagated all over the world. While Valmiki was thus contemplating, his disciples, Lava and Kush, who were dressed as rishis, came before him and touched his feet, as was their daily custom. Sita had given birth to the twin brothers while in exile, and they remained under Valmiki's care ever since. Sita's forced exile had come about when a citizen of Ayodhya doubted her chastity after being touched by the ten-headed monster, Ravana. Thus, Lord Ramachandra was forced to banish her. Their two sons, Lava and Kush, were gifted with fine memories and musical abilities. Moreover, they were well-versed in the Vedas. Physically, the twins were exact replicas of their father, and musically, they were as talented as the heavenly Gandharvas. Thus, as Valmiki gazed fondly upon the twins, he realized that they were fully qualified to receive the Ramayana. Thereafter, Valmiki proceeded to teach Lava and Kush the entire Ramayana with great care. The twins committed the entire text to memory. Following Valmiki's instructions, they chanted Lord Ramachandra's wonderful pastimes before great sages, learned brahmanas, and other pious men pure in heart. The learned brahmanas experienced great transcendental pleasure in reciting the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. They praised Lava and Kush, rewarding them with many valuable gifts. From that day, Lava and Kush began traveling all over the world, reciting the epic Ramayana. In the course of their wanderings, they eventually came to Ayodhya. There, Lord Ramachandra saw the two boys wandering through the city streets dressed in the garb of rishis. Upon hearing the wide acclaim of their expert recitation of his transcendental pastimes, Lord Ram took great pleasure in inviting them to his palace to recite the Ramayana. Still, although they were his sons, he did not recognize them. After respectfully receiving the twin sages, the Lord invited them into his royal assembly. Lord Ram observed that the boys, although dressed as ascetic brahmanas, had the features of kshatriyas. Speaking to his brothers, Bharat, Lakshman, and Shatrughna, Ram said, "O best of King Raghu's dynasty, please listen to this wonderful narration. Although these two singers appear like ascetics, they have the marks of great rulers. Listen to this story because it is full of literary beauty and has universal appeal." As Lava and Kush began the narration of the beautiful epic poem, Ram and his brothers soon forgot everything else, becoming fully absorbed in hearing the Ramayana. The bonds of material existence can be completely cut by simply chanting and hearing the Lord's glories. The great tract of land known as Kosala extended along the banks of the Sarayu River. This land was verdant, prosperous, and rich in grain. Within this vast territory was the renowned city of Ayodhya, built by the desire of Vaivasvata Manu, the ruler of mankind. This glorious city was 96 miles long and 24 miles wide. It was well laid out, and its beautiful straight roads were perfumed with scented water sprayed from the trunks of intoxicated elephants. Each day the damsels of the celestial planets hovered above it in their beautiful airplanes and showered it with flowers. The arch gateways of Ayodhya were made by marble, and the gates were wrought with gold and silver and embedded with precious jewels. Cannons and catapults, capable of repulsing any enemy, protected the city walls. The marketplaces were well planned, and 77-story houses symmetrically lined the streets. Adorned with multi-storied palaces and surrounded with exquisite gardens, Ayodhya resounded with the vibrations of musical instruments, rivaling Amaravati, the abode of the heavenly King Indra. Throughout the city, bards and singers recited the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and dancers acted out the Lord's pastimes for everyone's benefit. Within Ayodhya were many beautiful gardens abounding with flowers and shaded by fruit trees. Blue, red, and golden lotuses filled the ponds, and fountains shot water high into the sky. Gentle breezes carried the aromatic spray from the fountains, cooling the citizens by their touch and making even a hot summer day seem like spring. The sounds of cranes and peacocks could be heard everywhere. The water flowing through Ayodhya's streams and rivulets tasted as sweet as sugarcane sap, and it was used not only for drinking but for irrigating numerous mango orchards. Many houses and palaces perfectly designed were built of precious stones and decorated with flags and festoons. Their beauty rivaled the palaces of Vaikuntha. Thousands of warriors protected the great city. Skilled archers, well-versed in the use of weapons, and chariot fighters who were able to fight with thousands of men at a time. The streets leading into Ayodhya, princes from all parts of the world came to render their annual tribute and pay respects to the king of Ayodhya. Traders from near and far flocked to the markets to barter. Prominent priests could often be seen pouring ghee, sacrificial fires, and chanting Vedic hymns, proclaiming the glories of Lord Vishnu. Having mastered their senses and devoted themselves to truth, these Brahmins were blessed with all good qualities. Maharaj Dasharath was the emperor of the entire world and was a great Rajarshi, considered all Maharshi, a formidable warrior capable of fighting alone with an unlimited number of opponents. Because he was a picture of perfect Vedic civilization. Every imaginable opulence was exhibited in perfection. Were practically non-existent. In Ayodhya, the four social orders, namely the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, participated cooperatively for the peace and prosperity of the kingdom. No one cheated and no one was miserly. Arrogance, atheism, and harsh behavior and speech were conspicuous by their absence. Even though Maharaj Dasharath possessed such fantastic opulence and prestige, he remained unhappy. Try as he may, the king was unable to beget a son to continue his dynasty. Finally, after much to perform a horse sacrifice for the purpose of getting a son. With this in mind, he sent his chief minister, Sumantra, to call for his family priests. As a footnote to the horse sacrifice, Srila Prabhupada explains that Vedic sacrifice is not an ordinary performance. The demigods used to participate in such sacrifices, and the animal sacrifice was reincarnated with new life. In this age of Kali, there are no powerful brahmanas who can invite the demigods or give renewed life to animals. Formerly, the brahmanas, well conversant in Vedic mantras, could show the potency of the mantras. But in this age, because there are no such brahmanas, all such sacrifices are forbidden. Continue with the text. When the brahmanas, headed by Vasishta, address him, saying, "O best among the twice-born, for many years I have ardently desired to beget a son. However, all my efforts have been in vain. Because I am without an heir, I can no longer feign happiness. Indeed, my days seem wasted and are filled with grief. Thus, after much careful consideration, and with your kind permission, I have decided to perform a horse sacrifice. Because you are fully knowledgeable in scripture, I am confident that you will be able to lead me on the proper path." The priests unanimously approved of Maharaj Dasarath's idea to perform the horse sacrifice, and thereafter the king ordered his ministers to make all necessary arrangements without delay. We're destined to take place in the future. Due to some offenses on the part of King Romapad, there once came to be an extremely severe drought within his kingdom, causing great fear among all the living beings. When the conditions became intolerable, Maharaj Romapad summoned his council of learned brahmanas and inquired from them the cause of the drought. "I know that it is because of some fault of mine that this terrible drought has now overcome my kingdom. O best of the twice-born, because your knowledge is boundless, please prescribe the proper atonement for my past sins." The brahmanas replied, "O king, there is a great brahmana sage named Mrigi Rishi who is residing in the forest. Mrigi Rishi is the son of Kashyapa, and his son is named Rishashringa." Footnote: the name Rishashringa indicates that the young sage was born with a deer-like horn growing out of his forehead. "If you can bring this Rishi's son to your kingdom and give him your daughter, Shanta, in marriage, the drought will immediately end." Shanta was actually the daughter of Maharaj Dasharath, but had been given to the king's childless friend, Romapad, at the latter's request. King Romapad was very glad to learn the means for ending the drought, but when he requested his priests to summon Rishashringa, they refused. The brahmanas explained, "O king, we fear that Mrigi Rishi will curse us if we try to lure his son away from home. Rishashringa has been brought up by his father in complete isolation. He has never even seen another human being. Because Rishashringa has never once beheld a member of the fair sex, he is completely unaware of the pleasure of their association. My dear king, since we desire your welfare, we have devised a method for bringing Rishashringa to your kingdom. Have the most beautiful of courtesans go there and allure him with their feminine ways. We are certain that by this means your aim will easily be accomplished." Maharaj Romapad agreed to their plan and then sent for the foremost of young and beautiful prostitutes. After being thus instructed by the king and promised sufficient rewards, the girls departed for the forest, determined to bring back the young Rishi at all costs. Thereafter, the prostitutes set up their camp at the ashrama of Mrigi Rishi and waited for the opportune time. It so happened that one day Rishi came to the camp of the prostitutes. Seeing him, the girls jubilantly approached Rishashringa. When they asked about his identity, the boy replied, I'm the son of Mrigi Rishi, and I am engaged in performing austerities nearby at my father's ashrama. How wonderfully beautiful all of you are to look at. I wish you would come to my home and accept my worship and hospitality. The prostitutes then went with Rishashinga, where they were very nicely received at his ashrama with offerings of water to drink, water for washing their feet, and various kinds of fruits and roots. However, the girls were extremely afraid of the father's imminent return and did not wish to stay too long. As the prostitutes were leaving, they said, "My dear friend, our customs for receiving guests are quite different from yours. Now please accept our offerings of honor and respect in return." Saying this, the girls embraced Rishashringa tightly with great affection and then fed him sumptuous sweets. Never before had the Rishi's innocent son tasted anything so pleasing, for he had been accustomed to eating only fruits and roots. Indeed, he thought that the sweets were a type of wonderful fruit. Moreover, since he had previously seen only his father, he took the prostitutes to be enchantingly beautiful men. After the girls departed, Rishashringa began to experience feelings of unease and restlessness within his heart. The seed of lusty desire, which had remained dormant within his heart, had sprouted. Rishashringa began to constantly think of the beautiful women. Rishashringa could hardly sleep that night. His mind and heart became overwhelmed by thoughts of their sweet speech and tender embraces. Unable to think of anything else, the following day Rishashringa went to the prostitutes' camp. The girls received Rishashringa with great delight and then explained, "This is not our real home. Please come aboard our magnificent floating hermitage and accompany us to a place where we will be able to entertain you in a much better fashion. We have many nice varieties of fruits and roots, and we shall pass the time so enjoyably that you will hardly be able to perceive how time is passing." Being captivated at heart, Rishashringa unhesitatingly accompanied the prostitutes. Thus, the women allured him back to the capital of Romapad within the kingdom of Unga. Indeed, even as Rishashringa was being carried down the Ganga, Indra began to shed forth showers of rain, giving joy to all the living creatures. As soon as he understood that Rishashringa had arrived, King Romapad came out from his palace and bowed down before the young Rishi. Then, after worshipping Rishashringa with great attention, Romapad escorted him to the inner apartments of his palace, where he presented his daughter to the Rishi in charity. When he could understand that Rishashringa was fully satisfied, Maharaj Romapad begged from him the benediction that neither he nor his father would show their wrath toward him because of the duplicitous manner in which he had allured Rishashringa away from home. Rishashringa gave the king his assurance, and thereafter the marriage between him and Shanta was celebrated with great festivity. After the wedding, the newly married couple continued to live in Maharaj Romapad's palace and thus passed their days happily in royal comfort. Sumantra concluded his narration to Maharaj Dasharath. "O King, Sanat Kumara predicted that you would take help from your friend Romapad by requesting him to allow Rishashringa to come to the kingdom of Kosala and perform a horse sacrifice. It was further indicated that after the performance of the horse sacrifice, you would gain the fulfillment of your desires by receiving 4 incomparable sons." Maharaj Dasharath was very pleased to hear this story from Sumantra. Then, without delay, he went with his retinue to the kingdom of Unga. There he was received by Maharaj Romapad with great respect, and at that time the king of Unga informed Rishashringa that Dasharath was his real father-in-law. After enjoying Romapad's hospitality for about 1 week, Maharaj Dasharath addressed his friend as follows: "For a long time I have been morose on account of not having a son to perpetuate my illustrious dynasty. Now I beg you to allow Rishashringa to come to Ayodhya to perform a horse sacrifice on my behalf." Romapad happily agreed, and Maharaj Dasharath soon returned to his capital with Rishashringa and Shanta. Then when spring arrives, Maharaj Dasharath humbly approached Rishashringa, begging him for instructions regarding the performance of the horse sacrifice. Thus preparations for the sacrifice commenced, and a site was selected on the northern bank of the river Sarayu. The system was for an emperor to send a challenge horse all over the world to establish his supremacy over subordinate kings. The horse would be accompanied by soldiers of the emperor, and upon its arrival in a kingdom, the local king would either have to offer tribute to the emperor's representatives or fight to capture the horse. Any ruling prince or king was at liberty either to express his tacit willingness to obey the emperor or to accept the challenge and thus disobey the supremacy of the particular emperor. One who accepted the challenge had to fight with the emperor's men and establish his own supremacy by victory. The defeated challenger would have to sacrifice his life, making place for another king or ruler. Only when the horse returned after touring the world with no more challengers left could a horse sacrifice begin. Understanding that King Janak would be the future father-in-law of his sons, Maharaj Dasharatha sent him the first invitation. Likewise, other subordinate kings were requested to attend the sacrifice. After one full year, the challenge horse returned to Ayodhya, having wandered over the earth under the protection of 400 princes. Only then could the sacrifice begin. After the preliminary rites had been performed, Maharaj Dasharatha's eldest queen, Kaushalya, circumambulated the challenge horse, which was tied to one of the sacrificial stakes. Then, with three strokes of a sword, she severed the horse's head as prescribed by scriptural injunction. Thereafter, Rishishringa offered the fat of the dead horse into the sacrificial fire. Maharaj Dasharatha was directed to inhale the fumes to free him from all sins. Then the assisting priest offered the limbs of the horse into the sacrificial fire, bringing the three-day sacrifice to an end. Maharaj Dasharatha then gave away the four directions of the earth in charity to the four chief priests. The Brahmanins returned the gifts, however, saying, "O King, we are devoted to Vedic study and the performance of austerities and have no interest in ruling over a kingdom. Therefore, please give us other gifts, like cows and gold." Rishishringa then approached Maharaj Dasharatha, saying, "My dear King, you will surely receive four glorious sons. However, I propose that a separate sacrifice known as Putreshti be performed for that purpose." Maharaj Dasharatha readily assented, and soon the sacrifice was begun. Meanwhile, in the higher planets, the chief demigods approached Lord Brahma and explained, "O grandsire, because of your benedictions, Ravana has become so powerful that he is harassing everyone at will. Even we cannot subdue the wicked Rakshasa. Therefore, we request you to personally devise the means for his destruction." Lord Brahma considered the situation and then replied, "At the time of asking for benedictions, Ravana did not bother to ask for immunity from death at the hands of human beings, for he considered them to be too insignificant." While Brahma was thinking how Ravana could be killed, Lord Vishnu suddenly appeared riding on his carrier Garuda. As effulgent as many suns, Lord Vishnu appeared in his forearm form, dressed in bright saffron garments, and carrying his disc, conch, club, and lotus flower. The demigods worshipped the Supreme Lord with great reverence and then requested, "O Master of the Universe, please come to our rescue by dividing yourself into four, becoming the sons of Maharaj Dasharatha for the purpose of killing Ravana." Lord Vishnu replied, "Rest assured, there is no longer any need to be afraid. I will soon incarnate to rule over the earth for 11,000 years after vanquishing your enemy, the king of the Rakshasas." After saying this, Lord Vishnu disappeared as the demigods looked on with wonder. Meanwhile, from the sacrificial fire of Maharaj Dasharatha, there appeared an exceptional being of dark complexion with all auspicious bodily features. This personality appeared to be unlimitedly powerful. He was decorated with transcendental ornaments, and in his hand he carried a large golden pot of sweet rice. That divine person told Maharaj Dasharatha, "I am a messenger of Lord Vishnu." With folded hands, the king replied, "O Vishnu Duta, please order me to perform whatever service I can render." The servant of Lord Vishnu said, "This pot of sweet rice is the reward for your two sacrificial performances. Give portions to your three wives to eat. Through them you shall beget four sons who will forever perpetuate your fame." Maharaj Dasharatha happily accepted the sweet rice and circumambulated the Vishnu Duta. After Lord Vishnu's messenger disappeared from view, Maharaj Dasharatha quickly gave portions of the sweet rice to his wives, for he was eager to have sons. Maharaj Dasharatha gave Kaushalya one half of the sweet rice, Sumitra one fourth, and Kaikeyi one eighth. Then, after some deliberation, he gave the remaining eighth to Sumitra. All three wives were overjoyed, for they were confident that they would soon become mothers. The three queens eagerly ate their shares, and soon thereafter each felt the presence of divine offspring within their wombs. When Maharaj Dasharatha understood that his wives were pregnant, he too became very satisfied. Meanwhile, Lord Brahma ordered the demigods as follows: "Beget partial manifestations of yourselves to assist Lord Vishnu in his forthcoming incarnation. The children which you produce in the form of monkeys by uniting with apsaras, she-monkeys, and female yakshas, nagas, vidyadharas, and other celestial beings must be capable of assuming any form at will and must possess all other mystic powers. In addition, they must be very intelligent, highly skilled in the use of weapons, having prowess almost equal to Lord Vishnu, and possess ethereal bodies." After receiving the order of Lord Brahma, Indra begot Vali, Surya begot Sugriv, Brihaspati begot Tara, Kuvera begot Gandamada, Vishwakarma begot Nala, Varuna begot Shushena, and Vayu begot Hanuman. Besides these principal monkeys, many thousands of others took birth to assist Lord Vishnu in his mission. All of them were gigantic like mountains and were very eager to fight with Ravana. Like the demigods who begot them, these monkeys were born just after conception. They were so powerful that they could agitate the ocean with their impetuous energy. There were three classes of these created beings: bears, monkeys, and monkeys that had long tails like cows. Because there were more than 10 million of these monkeys and bears, the earth soon became overrun with them as they wandered throughout the forest, eating wild fruits and various roots. After the completion of the Kutreshti sacrifice, the demigods who personally came to accept their offerings and the priests, Rishashringa and Shanta, departed for their respective residences. Then, after a pregnancy of 12 months, on the ninth day of the waxing bright fortnight in the month of Chaitra, Kaushalya gave birth to a son. This divine child had reddish eyes and lips, long arms, and was decorated with all auspicious markings. The son of Kaushalya represented one half of the potency of Lord Vishnu. Soon thereafter, a son representing one-fourth of the prowess of Lord Vishnu was born, of Kaikeyi, Maharaj Dasharatha's youngest queen. Then, 2 days after the appearance of Kaushalya's son, Sumitra gave birth to twins, each representing one-sixth of the potency of Lord Vishnu. All four of the newborn children highly resembled one another and were exceedingly effulgent and pleasing to behold. Indeed, upon the appearance of Maharaj Dasharatha's four sons, the demigods showered flowers from heaven, while the Gandharvas sang and played musical instruments as the Apsaras danced. In Ayodhya, there was a great festival as musicians, dancers, and actors crowded the streets with all the citizens participating in the merrymaking. Footnote: Srila Prabhupada explains, "Being prayed for by the demigods, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth Himself, directly appeared with his expansion and expansions of the expansion. Their holy names were Rama, Lakshman, Bharata, and Shatrughna. These celebrated incarnations thus appeared in four forms as the sons of Maharaj Dasharath. Lord Ramachandra and his brothers, Lakshmana, Bharata, and Shatrughna, are all Vishnu Tattva. The Supreme Personality of Godhead expands into many, many forms. Although they are one and the same, Vishnu Tattva has many forms and incarnations. The Lord is situated in many forms, such as Rama, Lakshman, Bharata, and Shatrughna, and these forms may exist in any part of his creation. All these forms exist permanently, eternally, as individual personalities of Godhead, and they resemble many candles, all equally powerful. Lord Ramachandra, Lakshman, Bharata, and Shatrughna, who, being Vishnu Tattva, are all equally powerful, became the sons of Maharaj Dasharath in response to the prayers by the demigods. Continuing with the text. 13 days after the birth of Kaushalya's child, Vasishtha Muni, the family priest of Maharaj Dasharath, performed the name-giving ceremony. The fortunate Rishi named the son of Kaushalya Rama, while the son of Kaikeyi was named Bharata. The twin sons of Sumitra were named Lakshmana and Shatrughna. Thereafter, Vasishtha took charge of performing all the purificatory rituals for the sons of Maharaj Dasharath, culminating with the sacred thread ceremony. Under Vasishtha's guidance, all four brothers became masters of the Vedas, great heroic warriors, and reservoirs of all godly qualities. From birth, however, Rama outshone his brothers in all respects. Quite naturally, he became the favorite son of Maharaj Dasharath. Likewise, from childhood, Lakshmana was very attached to Ram. Similarly, Ram was not willing to eat anything or even go to sleep without Lakshmana. Whenever Rama went hunting, Lakshmana unfailingly accompanied him. Shatrughna and Bharata were also very dear to each other and thus inseparable. After Ram, Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna completed their education, Maharaj Dasharath began to consult with his family priest, Vasishtha, about their marriages. During one such discussion, the great and powerful Brahma Rishi, Vishwamrita, arrived in Ayodhya. When he entered the palace, Maharaj Dasharath and Vasishtha immediately got up from their seats to greet him. After worshipping Vishwamrita properly, Dasharath brought him into the court and seated him on a throne. Maharaj Dasharath greeted Vishwamrita, saying, "O foremost of saintly persons, may all your endeavors to conquer repeated birth and death meet with success. I consider your coming here as welcome, a gift as nectar placed in one's own hands, as torrential rainfall after a long drought, as the birth of a son for one who was childless, as the recovery of a great treasure that was considered irrevocably lost, or the joy one feels on a festive occasion." When Vishwamrita then asked about Maharaj Dasharath's welfare, the king humbly replied, "O great Rishi, your coming here is a great blessing for me. Indeed, you have bestowed a great honor upon me. Please inform me of your desire, so that I may serve the purpose of your visit." Pleased with Maharaj Dasharath's reception, Vishwamrita replied, "I was engaged in the performance of a great sacrifice, and it had almost reached completion when two Rakshasas named Maricha and Sabahu interrupted the performance by dropping flesh and blood upon the sacrificial arena. These vicious Rakshasas are determined to frustrate my attempt. Thus, they have repeatedly polluted my altar. O King, so that I may successfully complete the sacrifice, I have come here to take your son Ram to my ashram to kill these terrible Rakshasas. Please do not hesitate to fulfill my request out of parental affection, for I assure you that Ram will easily be able to accomplish this task. In return for your generosity, I shall certainly give you ample benedictions. Therefore, please allow me to take Ram for just 10 days. You may rest assured that he will return here safely." Vishwamrita's words pierced the very core of Maharaj Dasharath's heart. The king's entire body began to tremble. Then, after the Rishi fell silent, he fainted upon his throne. Moments later, when Maharaj Dasharatha regained consciousness, he again considered the prospect of losing Ram and fainted for a second time, falling down onto the floor. After an hour, the king regained consciousness. Then after seeing Vishwamrita before him, he pleaded, "O foremost of sages and well-wisher of everyone, my dear son Ram is only 16 years old. He has not even finished his military training and has never entered the battlefield. Please, do not ask for my inexperienced son. Instead, let me accompany you along with an Akshohini of soldiers to kill the Rakshasas. However, if you insist that Ram must go, then let me and my army come to fight alongside him. My dear Vishwamrita, I'm an old man. Without Ram, I could not bear to continue living. Please tell me, who are these Rakshasas, and what is the extent of their prowess?" Vishwamrita replied, "The king of the Rakshasas is named Ravana, and he is now oppressing the entire world. When he does not personally obstruct a sacrifice, he deputes these two powerful Rakshasas, Maricha and Sabahu, to do the mischief." Upon hearing the name of Ravana, Maharaj Dasharatha became increasingly despondent. He said, "No one is capable of fighting with Ravana. Just these two Rakshasas are too formidable, either for my son or for me. Therefore, O Rishi, I cannot fulfill your request. Indeed, I cannot bear to think of allowing my son to accompany you." Becoming nearly mad with grief, Maharaj Dasharatha began to speak incoherently, refusing Vishwamrita's request. Thus the Rishi became highly insulted and angrily declared, "O foolish king, your impotence will cause the ruin of your dynasty. You have promised to serve me, and now you have gone back on your word. Such behavior toward a Brahmana has never before been heard in the Raghu dynasty. Therefore, I shall quickly leave this condemned place." Because of Vishwamrita's sudden anger, the earth began to shake, and even the demigods in heaven became afraid. Appraising the situation, Vasishtha hurriedly approached Maharaj Dasharatha, saying, "O king, do not destroy all your previously acquired merit by abandoning righteousness. You have made a solemn promise and must now fulfill Vishwamrita's request by giving him your son, Ram. I do not think you have anything to fear. Formerly, when Vishwamrita was a king, he received celestial weapons from Lord Shiva, which had been born of Daksha's daughters, Jaya and Suprabha. Vishwamrita will surely give these weapons to Ram, as well as the necessary prowess to kill the Rakshasas. Indeed, Vishwamrita could easily kill Maricha and Sabahu himself, but he is seeking Ram's help just to enhance the glory of your son." After hearing his preceptor's words, Maharaj Dasharatha's fear subsided. Allowing his mind to again become balanced, thus pacified, the king agreed to Vishwamrita's proposal. Maharaj Dasharatha then summoned Ram to the royal court. Because the two were inseparable, Lakshmana also presented himself before his father. Maharaj Dasharatha affectionately smelled his son's heads, and the brothers then departed, with Vishwamrita walking in front and Ram and Lakshman following, their bows in hand. As they left the palace, flowers showered on them from the sky. After walking along the banks of the river Sarayu for 12 miles, Vishwamrita stopped and said, "My dear Ram, please sip some water for purification. I shall now teach you two mantras known as Bala and Atibala. After learning them, you will become freed from the influence of fatigue and old age and also gain incomparable wisdom and strength. Although I know that these qualities already exist in you, I still want to impart these mantras unto you for your benefit." After receiving the mantras, Lord Ram shone with the brilliance of 1,000 suns. The three then spent the night happily on the banks of the Sarayu and the Ganga. Upon seeing an ashrama of rishis situated there, Ram inquired about its history. Vishwamrita then replied, This is the very place where Lord Shiva burnt Cupid to ashes after the god of love tried to disturb his deep meditation. The next morning, Vishwamrita and his two brothers and the two brothers crossed the Ganga. Well, in midstream, Rama could hear the loud sound of cascading water, although there seemed no apparent reason for the sound. Asked why this was so, Vishwamrita explained, "Once Lord Brahma created a lake from his mind. That reservoir of water became known as the Manasa Sarovara. The river Sarayu flows from that lake, and the sound you hear is the water coming down from the Manasa Sarovara and joining with the Ganga. O Ram, you should offer your prayers and obeisances to this sacred place." After arriving at the southern bank of the Ganga, Ram saw a dense, uninhabited forest, and thus he inquired, "This desolate forest invokes fear in the heart of whoever beholds it. Please tell me why." Vishwamrita replied, "After King Indra killed the apparent demon Vritrasura, he became overwhelmed by sinful reactions and lost his splendor. To restore Indra to his normal condition, the demigods bathed him in the Ganga water empowered with Vedic mantras. Then taking the water containing Indra's impurities, the demigods deposited it in this place. Because this land accepted his sinful reactions, Indra gave it the benediction that it would become a very prosperous country. In this way, two flourishing kingdoms named Malada and Karusha were established here. Later on, however, a wicked Rakshasi named Tataka came here and began to terrorize the citizens. This Rakshasa woman was the wife of Sunda, and their son is Maricha, whom I have brought you here to kill. Gradually, all the inhabitants of this place became so greatly harassed by Tataka that now it remains deserted. My dear Ram, I want you to destroy this she-demon today, freeing this country from its oppression. As long as this Rakshasi lives, no one will even dare to enter this forest." Lord Ram then asked, "O great Rishi, if it is appropriate, please explain how this Rakshasi became so powerful." Vishwamrita replied, "There was once a powerful Yaksha named Suketu, who pleased Lord Brahma by his performance of severe austerities. Being childless, Suketu desired a son, but instead Lord Brahma awarded him a powerful daughter. This very beautiful girl was named Tataka, and when she grew up, she was given in marriage to Sunda, the son of Jamba. Later, sage Agastya cursed Sunda to die. In their attempt to retaliate, Tataka and her son Maricha rushed at the Rishi, hoping to devour him. However, Agastya immediately cursed both mother and son to become man-eating Rakshasas. Thus, the beautiful Tataka became transformed into a horrible-looking ogress. Because Agastya Rishi used to meditate in this area, Tataka is obsessed with creating disturbances here." Vishwamrita continued, "My dear Ram, please understand that Tataka is thoroughly wicked. Therefore, cast aside all hesitation in killing a woman. Remember how Indra formerly killed Virochana's daughter when she desired to ravage the earth. Likewise, Lord Vishnu killed the wife of Bhrigu Muni when she had desired to slay Indra. Please then, shake off all uneasiness and prepare yourself to fulfill my command." Receiving this order, Ram twanged his bow. Its awesome sound reverberated throughout the four directions, terrifying all creatures that heard it. When Tataka heard the sound of Lord Ram's bow, she became simultaneously struck with wonder and inflamed with rage. She rushed madly toward the place from where the sound had emanated. When Ram saw her approaching, he exclaimed, "O Lakshman, just see this hideous and gigantic creature. She is so horrible that pious hearts break at the very sight of her. Still, since this Rakshasi is a woman, I shall not kill her. Instead, I will render her harmless by cutting off her hands, feet, nose, and ears. Thus mutilated, she will not be able to commit further crimes." Rushing forward, Tataka created a dust storm that temporarily blinded Ram and Lakshman. Then, using their powers of illusion, Tataka created a shower of stones. Regaining his composure, Ram smashed all the rocks to pieces and then quickly cut off Tataka's arms. Simultaneously, Lakshman cut off Tataka's ears and, at Ram's urging, the tip of her nose. However, by utilizing her mystic powers, Tataka immediately disappeared. While remaining invisible, she again began showering stones. With an impassioned voice, Vishwamrita then urged, "O Ram, twilight is rapidly approaching, and at that time the Rakshasa's prowess greatly increases. Therefore, give up your merciful attitude and kill Tataka at once." As Ram released a shower of arrows, Tataka suddenly became visible and rushed toward him. Undisturbed, Ram selected an especially powerful golden arrow from his quiver and shot it at the demoness. Although Tataka rushed forward at the speed of Indra's thunderbolt, Ram's single blazing arrow pierced Tataka's chest, causing her to fall to the ground dead, making a tumultuous sound. From the heavens, the demigods applauded and threw down showers of flowers. The Gandharvas and Apsaras began to sing and dance in ecstasy, and the great rishis praised the prowess of Lord Ram. The demigods, headed by Indra, then approached Vishwamrita in private and said, "O Rishi, because Ram has a very important mission to accomplish on our behalf, you should now impart to him all your knowledge of celestial weapons." After saying this, the demigods disappeared, and Vishwamrita, Ram, and Lakshman happily spent the night there. The next morning, Vishwamrita imparted unto Ram his complete knowledge of celestial weapons. When Ram received the mantras for those celestial weapons, the weapons appeared before him in their personified forms, saying, "O Ram, please give us your order. What service can we do for you?" Ram replied, "My request is that all of you appear before me when I think of you." After receiving this command, the personified weapons disappeared. Vishwamrita, Ram, and Lakshmana continued on their journey. Later in the day, as the party approached Vishwamrita's ashrama, known as Siddhashrama, Ram inquired from the rishi about the history of that holy place. Vishwamrita then explained, "Siddhashrama was formerly the abode of Lord Vaman, who dwelt there for many hundreds of millenniums. Once the demigods came to see Lord Vaman, requesting him to approach Bali Maharaj, who was engaged in performing sacrifices. Since the king of the demons had conquered the entire three worlds, the demigods petitioned Lord Vaman to take away his kingdom by begging. Just at this time, Kashyapa, who happened to arrive at Siddhashrama, and after worshipping Vamana with great devotion, he prayed for the Lord to appear as his son. The Lord agreed to do so, and thus he later took birth as the dwarf Brahmana, son of Kashyapa and Aditi. He thus fulfilled the purpose of the demigods by taking away the kingdom of Bali Maharaj on the plea of begging for three steps of land. After arriving at his ashrama, Vishwamrita immediately set about performing his sacrifice, while Ram and Lakshman, with bows in hand, awaited the arrival of Maricha and Sabahu. 6 days and nights passed as the two brothers guarded the sacrificial arena, completely foregoing sleep. Then on the critical sixth night, when the Soma Rasa was about to be extracted, the sacrificial fire suddenly blazed brightly, indicating the imminent arrival of the Rakshasas. Soon thereafter, a fearful clamor was heard in the sky. Maricha, Sabahu, and their followers swooped down without warning, causing torrents of blood, pus, stool, flesh, and other contaminated substances to rain down upon the sacrificial altar. Lord Ram then told Lakshmana, "I will subdue these evil Rakshasas with my weapons, but I shall not kill them, for they are destined to live some years more." Ram discharged a mighty weapon that struck Maricha in the chest and flung him 100 yojanas into the middle of the ocean, but didn't kill him. Then taking up another powerful arrow, Ram pierced Sabahu's chest, causing him to fall down dead upon the ground. By invoking a third weapon, Ram drove away all the other Rakshasas. Thereafter, the area again became calm. All the rishis who had previously resided at Siddhashrama joyfully came home and congratulated Lord Ram for his wonderful accomplishment. That evening, the sacrifice was successfully concluded. After passing the night, Ram came before the rishis and inquired, "O worshipable Brahmanas, now that this area has been freed from the disturbances caused by the Rakshasas, is there anything more we can do to be of service?" At the behest of Vishwamrita, the rishis replied, "We are about to depart for the kingdom of Mithila to take part in a grand sacrifice arranged by King Janak. We request you two brothers to accompany us. There is a wonderful bow being kept in the sacrificial arena that was formerly presented to the demigods by Lord Shiva. Later, the demigods gave the bow to Devavrata, who was the king of Mithila long ago. This celestial bow is immeasurably strong, and even great demigods cannot bend it, what to speak of human beings. The bow has remained at Mithila for a long time and is worshipped on an altar with flowers, sandalwood paste, and other auspicious articles." Ram agreed to accompany the rishis, and thereafter a great caravan set out with 100 cars loaded with the paraphernalia required for Janak Maharaj's sacrifice. After traveling all day, the party reached the banks of the Shona River, where they stopped for the night. Then, while he was seated at leisure, Ram asked Vishwamrita if there was any history he could narrate concerning that place. Thus, the rishi related to Ram the following story. Once there was a great rishi named Kush, a direct son of Lord Brahma. Kusha had 4 Kshatriya sons who founded 4 cities, one of which was on the banks of the river Shona. Kusha's son, Kushanaba, begot 100 daughters through the Apsara Grutachi. When these girls grew up, they were very beautiful and would happily play together on the banks of the river. Once the demigod of air, Vayu, happened to see the girls and became captivated by their exquisite beauty. Approaching them, Vayu said, "My dear beautiful girls, if you all become my wives, I shall transform your fleeting human beauty into ever-fresh celestial youthfulness." The girls had no attraction for Vayu, however, and instead felt insulted. They replied, "We would never think of choosing our own husbands. We will only marry according to the choice of our father. Being the daughters of a great Rajarshi, we certainly have the power to curse you for your vulgar behavior. However, we shall not do so, for we do not wish to diminish the accumulated merit of our austerities." Vayu, who is easily angered, became highly offended. Taking revenge, he subtly entered the bodies of the 100 girls and by his mystic power distorted their bodily features. When the girls returned to the palace crying, their father was shocked to see that they had all been transformed into hunchbacks. In reply to Kushanaba's inquiries, the girls related all that had happened. Maharaj Kushanaba congratulated his daughters for refraining from cursing Vayu and began considering how he could get them married. Previously, a great brahmachari named Chuli had been performing severe austerities. An unmarried Gandharva girl attended to him like a menial maidservant. Eventually, Chuli became pleased by her selfless service and offered her a benediction. The girl requested the rishi to give her an exceptional son while allowing her to remain a virgin. Chuli agreed, and thus appeared a mind-born son of great ascetic prowess named Brahmadatta. Later, Brahmadatta ruled as a king, and it was he whom Kushanaba decided would be a suitable match for his daughters. Thus, after being invited to Kushanaba's palace, Brahmadatta accepted the 100 girls. Upon touching their hands at the marriage ceremony, one after another, their bodily deformities vanished. and each girl became beautiful again. Vishwamrita then concluded his narration by explaining, Kushinaba had no son, however, so he performed a sacrifice for that purpose. As a result, Gaudi was later born to Kushinaba, and I am the son of King Gaudi. The next morning, the party continued their journey, and by evening they reached the bank of the Ganga. As they passed the night there, Rama requested Vishwamrita to narrate the history of the river Ganga. Thus, Vishwamrita related the following story. The presiding deity of the Himalayas, Himavan, begot two daughters by Mena, the daughter of Mount Meru, named Ganga and Uma. Once upon a time, Lord Brahma approached Himavan and requested him to allow the demigods to adopt Ganga for the future welfare of the universe. Himavan readily agreed and later gave his daughter Uma to Lord Shiva, for she had always meditated upon him while performing severe austerities. After receiving Uma, Lord Shiva began enjoying with her in an uninterrupted conjugal relationship. However, even after passing 100 celestial years in conjugal embrace, no offspring came from their combination. At this time, the demigods approached Lord Shiva and begged, "Please desist from your sexual activities, O Lord, for we fear that the offspring produced will be too powerful for the universe to bear. Instead, we humbly request you to restrain yourself and practice austerities and meditation." Lord Shiva replied, "I accept your proposal, for my heart is actually inclined towards self-realization. However, since my semen has already become unseated from my heart, it will have to be received somewhere." The demigods then suggested, "Let the earth, which can bear any amount of burden, receive your seed." Thereafter, Lord Shiva released his powerful semen, and it proceeded to cover the entire surface of the earth. Upon seeing this, the demigods feared the earth might crack. Thus, they began praying to Angi and Vayu, requesting them to devour the all-encompassing semen of Lord Shiva. In answer to the demigods' prayers, Agni took the help of Vayu and went to consume the semen. As soon as the fire god touched it, some of the Lord's semen turned into a white mountain, and a part of that further transformed into a thicket of effulgent white reeds. The rest of the semen remained unchanged and was conserved within Agni. The demigods were elated to see that the earth had been saved from the impending calamity. With grateful hearts, they went to worship Lord Shiva and his wife. However, Uma was very angry with the demigods for interrupting her while she was absorbed in sexual enjoyment. Seeing the demigods before her, Uma cursed them, saying, "May all your wives become barren. Likewise, let the earth not only remain childless, but also come to have an uneven surface and be ruled over by numerous kings." Thereafter, Lord Shiva and Parvati returned to the northern Himalayas to perform austerities. Sometime later, when the demigods were being harassed by the demons, they approached Lord Brahma, hoping to acquire a formidable military commander. In reply to the demigods' plea, Lord Brahma advised them, "Because of Parvati's curse, you are unable to produce a child to serve your purpose. Therefore, I suggest that Agni place the semen of Lord Shiva into the womb of Ganga. In this way, a heroic son will be begotten." Thereafter, the demigods approached Agni and related Lord Brahma's instructions. Hearing this, Agni approached the heavenly river, Mandakini Ganga. He then requested her to accept the semen of Lord Shiva, which he had been holding for a long time. Ganga agreed to the proposal. Then, after assuming a most beautiful form, she allowed herself to be impregnated by Agni. However, soon after receiving the fiery semen of Lord Shiva, Ganga Devi felt an intense, agonizing pain. With great agitation, she told Agni, "I cannot continue to bear the semen of Lord Shiva in my womb. Its burning is intolerable." Agni then instructed Ganga to cast off the semen at a certain place in the Himalayas. She hurriedly went there. In this way, the semen of Lord Shiva, which had acquired a shiny golden luster because of its contacting Ganga Devi, fell to the thicket of white reeds on the White Mountain. In this way, a wonderful child was born. Other portions of the semen that fell upon the earth transformed into gold and silver mines. Indeed, because of the fierce energy of Lord Shiva's semen, mines of copper and iron were created in distant places. After the birth of the child, the demigods brought six goddesses, namely Kritikas, to nurse him. They assured the women that the baby would come to be known as their son. For this reason, the child became known as Kartikeya. The boy was also called Skanda, which means to flow, because he had fallen from the womb of Ganga. Because he saw mothers before him, the baby assumed six faces to suck breast milk from all of them. Skanda was so strong that when he was only one day old, he killed many fierce demons. As the commander-in-chief of the demigods. Vishwamrita then related to Lord Ram the story of King Sagara, who long ago ruled the world from his capital, Ayodhya. Because Maharaj Sagara was unable to beget a son, he, along with his two wives, went to the Himalayas to perform austerities. After some time, the king was benedicted by the great Rishi Bhrigu with the boon that he would receive a son by one wife who would become the perpetuator of his dynasty, while his other wife would give birth to 60,000 more sons. Hearing this, the two queens questioned Bhrigu Muni who would receive the one son and who would receive the 60,000 sons. Bhrigu Muni replied that the decision would be left to them. Thus, Keshini, the elder queen, chose to have a single son who would perpetuate the Ikshvaku line. Sumati, the sister of Garuda, chose to have the 60,000 sons. Maharaj Sagara returned home, and in due course, a son was born to Keshini and given the name Asamanjasa. Sumati, however, gave birth to a lump of flesh shaped like a bitter melon. Shortly thereafter, when the lump was opened up, 60,000 embryonic sons emerged. They were immediately placed in jars of ghee by their nurses until they could complete their development. Later, when these 60,000 sons began growing up, their cruel elder stepbrother, Asamanjasa, began to throw them into the river Sarayu, laughing with great pleasure to see them drown. Being very aggrieved due to the vicious behavior of this son, Maharaj Sagara finally decided to exile Asamanjasa from his kingdom. Although he kept the son of Asamanjasa, Amshuman, who was loved by all the subjects. After some time, Maharaj Sagara inaugurated the performance of a horse sacrifice, with Amshuman protecting the challenged horse as it wandered over the earth. However, during the performance of the sacrifice, King Indra appeared in the guise of a Rakshasa and stole the horse from the sacrificial arena. The priest fervently urged Maharaj Sagara to recover the horse at all costs. He warned that if the sacrifice remained incomplete, it would be most inauspicious. Maharaj Sagara then ordered his 60,000 sons to search the entire earth for the horse, allotting each of them one square yojana. He further instructed his sons that if the horse could not be found elsewhere, they should look below the earth. Thus, as Maharaj Sagara and his grandson, Amshuman, waited at the sacrificial arena, the 60,000 princes searched the entire earth. When they were unable to find the horse anywhere, the sons of Sagara began digging into the earth. This, however, upset the inhabitants of the lower world, such as the Nagas. Indeed, even the earth herself became extremely disturbed. Seeing this, the demigods approached Lord Brahma and petitioned him to set right the situation. Lord Brahma pacified the demigods, explaining that since the earth was a consort of Lord Vishnu, the Lord, in his form of Kapila, would soon annihilate all 60,000 sons of Sagara. Even after digging up the earth and killing many living beings in the process, the sons of Sagara could not find the sacrificial horse, and thus returned to their father disappointed. When the 60,000 princes inquired from their father what they should do next, the king ordered them to continue digging further down until the horse was found. The sons of Sagara resumed their excavation of all four quarters of the earth's surface and soon came to see the four colossal elephants that protect the four directions and support the earth. These gigantic elephants support the entire weight of the earth upon their backs, and when, due to exhaustion, they sometimes shake their heads for relief, it creates earthquakes. Finally, after penetrating the earth all the way down to Rasatala, the sons of Sagara came upon Lord Kapila sitting in meditation, while nearby the sacrificial horse stood grazing peacefully. Sagara's sons assumed Kapila to be the chief, to be the thief. Thus they angrily took up their digging implements and rushed to kill him. Seeing this act of aggression, Kapila became angry. Then simply by uttering the mantra, hum, he reduced the 60,000 sons of Sagara to ashes. After a long time, when his sons had not returned, Maharaj Sagara sent his grandson, Amshuman, to search for his 60,000 sons and the sacrificial horse. By following the path his uncles had taken, Amshuman came to the passage excavated by them. After entering the earth, Amshuman came upon the great elephants and inquired from them about the whereabouts of his uncles. In reply, the elephants assured him that by continuing down the passage, he would soon come to know everything. At last, Amshuman reached the place where the ashes of the sons of Sagara lay. Seeing this, he became overwhelmed with grief. Amshuman found the sacrificial horse nearby and decided to first offer water for the departed souls of his uncles before returning to his grandfather. Unfortunately, there was no water to be found in that place. While Amshuman was thinking what to do, Garuda suddenly appeared and said, "My dear Amshuman, do not grieve for your uncles. Their deaths are ultimately meant for achieving a glorious purpose. The sons of King Sagara will be instrumental in bringing the sacred river Ganga down to earth for the welfare of all people. Your uncles were burnt to ashes by the great sage Kapila. When their remains are washed over by the waters of the Ganga, they will attain a heavenly destination. Now take the sacrificial horse and return to your grandfather so that the sacrifice may be completed." With the return of the sacrificial horse, Maharaj Sagara successfully concluded the sacrifice. After hearing from Amshuman the prophetic words of Garuda, the king became absorbed in trying to formulate the means to make the Ganga descend to earth. However, Maharaj Sagara passed away before achieving that goal. After the death of his grandfather, Amshuman ruled the kingdom for some time. He later gave the throne to his son, Dilip, and retired to the forest to perform austerities, hoping to induce Ganga to descend to earth. After his death, Amshuman went to the heavenly planets, but his desire to cause the descent of the Ganga remained unfulfilled. Dilip also sought to bring Ganga to earth, but he too died before his desire was fulfilled. Dilip's son, Bhagirath, then inherited the kingdom and likewise desired to perform austerities to cause Ganga to descend. Since he had no son, Bhagirath entrusted the rule of the kingdom to his ministers and retired to the forest. After Maharaj Bhagirath had performed austerities for 1,000 years, Lord Brahma became pleased with him. Accompanied by the demigods, Lord Brahma appeared before the king to award him a benediction. Maharaj Bhagirath worshipped Lord Brahma and then begged, "Please allow my ancestors, the sons of King Sagara, to receive the water of the Ganga. In addition, kindly benedict me to have a son. Lord Brahma replied, I agree to award you these benedictions. However, the earth is incapable of bearing the weight of Ganga's descent. You should request Lord Shiva to absorb the impact of the falling water, for he is powerful enough, to do so. Determined to gain Lord Shiva's favor, Maharaj Bhagirath began performing severe austerities. He stood motionless on the tip of a single toe for 1 year. At that time, Lord Shiva was pleased to appear before the king. When Maharaj Bhagirath expressed his desire, Lord Mahadev agreed to bear the force of the Ganga's falling water upon his head. Soon afterward, the Ganga began to descend toward the earth from her course in the heavenly planets. All the demigods assembled to witness the spectacle. However, when Ganga Devi saw Lord Shiva prepared to take her upon his head, she considered that his contact would contaminate her. Thus, upon seeing the expression of disgust displayed by Ganga Devi, Lord Shiva became insulted. In retaliation, he angrily captured her and concealed her waters within his matted hair, thwarting her descent to earth. When Maharaj Bhagirath saw how Ganga had become entangled, he resumed his austerities. Finally, Lord Shiva gave up his anger and released Ganga Devi, allowing her to fall into the Bindu Sarovara in the Himalayas. Afterwards, the Ganga split into seven streams. Six of these formed other rivers, while the seventh followed Maharaj Bhagirath as he rode upon his royal chariot. While wending her way through various lands, it so appeared that the Ganga inundated the sacrificial arena of the great sage Janu. Becoming excited with rage, the Rishi swallowed up the entire river. Upon seeing this, the demigods were struck with wonder. They then approached Janu and requested him to release Ganga Devi on the condition that she would become known as his daughter. The Rishi agreed, and thus the Ganga was able to continue her journey. Finally, the Ganga reached the site that had been excavated by the sons of Sagara. By entering that great crevasse, the Ganga went down to Rasatala. In doing so, she submerged the ashes of Sagara's 60,000 sons, enabling them to reach their heavenly destination. Lord Brahma appeared once more before Maharaj Bhagirath and declared, O King, your mission has now been accomplished. From this time forward, the Ganga shall be known as your daughter, Bhagirathi. After thus delivering his forefathers, Maharaj Bhagirath returned to his capital and resumed ruling over his kingdom. Thus the entire night passed away as Vishwamrita narrated to Ram the fascinating history of the river Ganga and her descent to earth. When morning arrived, Ram expressed his eagerness to cross the Ganga and continue the journey. The caravan was soon made ready to depart. After reaching the far bank of the Ganga, the caravan traveled on and eventually came to the city of Vishala. When Lord Ram requested Vishwamrita to speak about the dynasty of kings that ruled this city, the Rishi narrated the following story. The demigods and demons are by nature inimical toward one another. Once, following the advice of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demigods executed a truce with the demons for the purpose of churning nectar from the sea. This was done with the understanding that when the nectar was churned, both sides would share it equally. Thus, both the demons and the demigods, desiring to become immortal, started for the ocean of milk, taking with them Mandara Mountain and Vasuki. By the expert arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demons held the snake near the mouth, and the demigods held his tail. Vasuki, with his thousands of eyes and mouths, breathed smoke and blazing fire, which severely wounded the demons. Thus the demons, who appeared like trees burned by a forest fire, gradually became powerless. Because the demigods were also affected by the blazing breath of Vasuki, their bodily luster diminished, and their garments, garlands, weapons, and faces were blackened by smoke. However, by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, clouds appeared on the sea, pouring torrents of rain, and strong breezes carried particles of water from the sea waves, thus giving relief to the demigods. Because of the mountain's great weight, the demigods and demons became fatigued, and some were dying. Thus, because Mandara Mountain was very heavy and was not held by any support, it sank into the ocean. In this way, the prowess of both the demons and the demigods was vanquished. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu then appeared on the back of his carrier, Garuda. The Lord appeared like a blackish cloud. Wearing a garland of flowers, he was dressed with yellow garments and earrings that shone on his ears like lightning. His eyes were pinkish, and his hair was spread over his shoulders. By his mercy, he brought the demigods and demons back to life. The Lord then lifted the mountain with one hand and placed it on the back of Garuda. Then he sat on the mountain, and Garuda carried him to the spot of the churning and placed the mountain in the middle of the sea. The Lord then asked Garuda to leave, because as long as Garuda was present, Vasuki could not come there. The Supreme Personality of Godhead appearing in his incarnation as Kurma Avatar, a gigantic tortoise, supported the mountain upon his back as he lay at the bottom of the ocean. Then Lord Vishnu used his strong, glorious arms, which award fearlessness throughout the universe, and took hold of Vasuki like a rope and began churning the ocean using Mandara Mountain as a churning rod. Engaged in this way, the Lord appeared like the beautifully situated mountain named Indranila. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Lord Vishnu then further expanded himself in a gigantic form and supported the top of Mount Mandara with one hand to keep it steady. As the churning resumed with great force, the fish, sharks, tortoises, and snakes became agitated. The entire ocean became turbulent, and even the large aquatic animals like whales, water elephants, crocodiles, and Timangila fish, large whales that can swallow small whales, came to the surface. While the ocean was being churned in this way, it first produced a large amount of dangerous poison called halahala. The demigods, seeing no one else to save them, approached Lord Shiva and offered him prayers. Lord Shiva is called Ashutosh because he is very pleased if one becomes his devotee. Therefore, he readily agreed to drink all the poison generated by the churning. The goddess Durga, Lord Shiva's wife, was not at all disturbed when Lord Shiva agreed to drink the poison, for she knew Lord Shiva's prowess. Indeed, she was pleased with this agreement. Lord Shiva gathered the devastating poison, which had spread everywhere. He took it in his hand and drank it, which made his neck become bluish. However, a small quantity of the poison spilled from his hands to the ground. It is because of this poison that there are poisonous snakes, scorpions, toxic plants, and other poisonous things in the world. Thereafter, in the course of churning the milk ocean, 600 million apsaras were produced. And because neither the demigods or demons accepted them, they became prostitutes. When Varuni, the goddess of liquor, Sura, next emerged from the milk ocean, the demons would not accept her. The demigods did, however, and for this reason, the sons of Aditi became known as Suras, where the sons of Diti became known as Asuras. Finally, after many years, Lord Vishnu, in the form of Dhanvantri, the inaugurator of the medical science, appeared from the ocean of milk, holding a water pot filled with nectar in one hand and a staff in the other. A great fight ensued between the demigods and demons over the nectar. When both sides neared destruction, the demons took possession of the nectar. Lord Vishnu then assumed the form of Mohini Murti. When this extraordinarily beautiful form of the Lord, as a young woman, appeared before them, the demons immediately became captivated by her. Because the demons were then fighting amongst themselves to possess the nectar, they selected this beautiful woman to settle their quarrel. Taking advantage of their weakness, Mohini, the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, enticed the demons to promise that whatever decision she gave, they would agree to. When the demons made this promise, Mohinimurti had the demigods and demons sit in different lines so that she could distribute the nectar. Mohinimurti approached the demons and spoke graciously to them. The demons thought themselves most fortunate to talk with her. Since the demigods were seated at a distant place, the demons thought they would get only a small portion of the nectar. Indeed, the demons concluded that because Mohinimurti appeared so pleased with them, she would give the demons all the nectar. Enchanted by the exquisite transcendental beauty of the Mohini form, the demons agreed to hand over the nectar to Mohini Devi, who then artfully delivered it to the demigods. The demons were so captivated by the tricks and friendly words of Mohinimurti that although the demigods were served first, the demons were pacified merely by her sweet words. The Lord said to the demons, "The demigods are very miserly and are excessively anxious to take the nectar first. Let them have it first. Since you are not like them, you can wait a little longer. You are all heroes and are therefore pleased with me. It is better for you to wait until after the demigods drink." The Lord intended to distribute the nectar only to the demigods. She knew that the demons were quite unfit to drink the nectar. When the demons saw that Mohinimurti was cheating them, however, they remained silent. Nevertheless, one demon named Rahu dressed himself like a demigod and sat down in the line of the demigods, sitting beside the sun and the moon. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead understood how Rahu was cheating, he immediately cut off the demon's head. Rahu, however, had already tasted the nectar, and therefore, although his head was severed, he remained alive. After the demigods finished drinking the nectar, the Supreme Personality of Godhead assumed his own form and quickly carried off the nectar by an act of deception. When the demons opposed her, Mohinimurti easily vanquished them and thus enabled Indra to become the undisputed ruler of the three worlds. Upon seeing the defeat of her sons, Diti became very unhappy and began performing austerities with the aim of obtaining a son capable of killing Indra in revenge. Knowing that Diti was intent upon performing austerities for 1,000 years to attain his destruction, Indra came to her and began rendering menial service to her with great care and attention. When only 10 years of her vow remained, being pleased with Indra, assured him that she would pacify her son once he was born, so that Indra could continue ruling over the three worlds without fear. Indra, however, remained wary. Sometime later, Diti became very tired and carelessly laid down, placing her head where her feet normally would rest. In this way, Diti neglectfully allowed her hair to become contaminated. Taking advantage of this fault, Indra utilized his mystic power to enter her womb. Indra then cut Diti's embryo into 7 parts. When the fetus cried out in a shrill voice, he again cut each part into 7, making a total of 49 pieces. Diti, however, could understand what was happening and begged Indra to stop killing her child. Having been discovered, the repentant Indra came out from her womb and begged forgiveness from his stepmother. Thus Diti requested that her 49 children be allowed to become wind gods. Indra agreed, and thus he and Diti were reconciled, while the 49 children became recognized as demigods known as the Maruts. Vishramrita concluded, "This city, Vishala, is situated at the place where Diti formerly performed her austerities. Later, the son of Ikshvaku, named Vishala, built the city, and the present king in his dynasty is Sumati. Maharaj Sumati then came out of the city to receive and worship Vishramrita. At his invitation, the party rested there for the night. The next morning, the caravan again proceeded on its journey toward the kingdom of Videha. Upon reaching the outskirts of Mithila, the capital city of Maharaj Janak, Lord Ram saw an old desolate hermitage. After Ram inquired about it from Vishramrita, the rishi explained, "This ashrama formerly belonged to Gautama Rishi, who practiced austerities here along with his wife, Ahalya. Once upon a time, knowing that Gotama was away from his ashrama, King Indra assumed the form, a form, that closely resembled the rishi. He went to the ashrama in that disguise and approached Gotama's wife, saying, "My dear beautiful one, I desire union with you immediately. Please do not disappoint me." Although Ahalya recognized that it was Indra disguised as Gotama, she did not refuse him, for she, too, eagerly desired his embraces. Thus the union took place, and after their lusty urges had been gratified, Ahalya begged, "O Indra, please protect us from the wrath of my husband, Gotama." Indra assured Ahalya that he would depart immediately, unnoticed by anyone. However, while Indra was sneaking away from Gotama's ashrama, the rishi suddenly returned. When Gotama saw Indra disguised as himself, his head hanging down in shame, he could well understand the nature of his misconduct. Thus, with great anger, the rishi cursed Indra, "O lusty fool, may your testicles immediately fall off as punishment for this abominable act." No sooner had the curse been pronounced when Indra's testicles fell from his body and dropped to the ground. Then, after entering his ashrama, Gotama cursed his wife, "O wretched woman, from now on you shall be incapable of eating or drinking, and you will have to lie down on a bed of ashes." Thus Ahalya was turned into a pillar of stone. Gotama then said, "Only when Lord Ram visits this spot in the distant future will you be absolved of your sin, freed from all lusty desires, and reunited with me as your husband." Saying this, Gotama departed for the Himalayas. Meanwhile, Indra informed the demigods, "I have successfully thwarted Gotama Rishi's attempt to attain my position as king of heaven by making him angry. However, in the process, I have lost my testicles. Now, somehow or other, please arrange for my manhood to be restored." Responding to Indra's plea, the demigods arranged for the Pitas to castrate a ram and grafted his testicles onto Indra's body. After narrating this story, Vishwamrita invited Lord Rama to enter the ashrama of Gotama. As soon as Rama entered the hermitage, Ahalya regained her original form, dazzling with ascetic splendor. Indeed, upon Ahalya's liberation, there was a sudden shower of celestial flowers with drums beating in the heavens. Ram and Lakshman respectfully touched Ahalya's feet, and she reciprocally welcomed the two brothers and Vishwamrita. Gotama Rishi then came to be reunited with his wife and worshiped Lord Ram and Lakshman with great reverence. Thereafter, the caravan entered Mathila. Upon arriving at the sacrificial arena of King Janak, Lord Ram was pleased to see that thousands of brahmanas had assembled from all parts of the world. Hearing of Vishwamrita's arrival, Maharaj Janak hurriedly went to greet him and addressed him, saying, "O best of saintly persons, this sacrifice will take 12 days to complete, with the demigods appearing personally to accept their shares of the offerings. My dear sir, please tell me who these two exalted personalities are that have accompanied you. Indeed, they appear to be like gods in human form." Vishwamrita replied, "These two young men are Ram and Lakshman, the sons of King Dasharath. They have come here to examine the great bow that you have been worshipping. I brought them from Ayodhya to my ashram to kill the rakshasas that were disturbing my sacrifice. On the way, they killed the she-demon, Tataka. And then, at Siddhashrama, Ram hurled Maricha 100 yojanas into the sea and killed Subahu. Before arriving at Mathila, Ram freed Ahalya from her husband's curse and received the worship of Gotama Rishi." Later, when everyone was comfortably seated, Satananda, the chief priest of Maharaj Janak and eldest son of Gotama Rishi, requested Vishwamrita to recount in detail the story of how his mother had regained her original form at the sight of Lord Ram. The Rishi then happily related the entire incident. Thereafter, Satananda reciprocated by narrating the glorious story of Vishwamrita. Vishwamrita was born as the son of Gadi and formerly ruled his kingdom as a righteous Kshatriya. Once taking an Akshohini of soldiers with him, Vishwamrita began to travel over the earth. In due course of time, he came upon the hermitage of the great Brahma Rishi Vasishta. Entering the beautiful hermitage, which was inhabited by many sages, he bowed respectfully before Vasishta. The Rishi received Vishwamrita cordially, and the two became engaged in friendly conversation. Vasishta said, "My dear king, please remain here for a few days as my guest, and guest so that I may entertain you in a manner befitting your position." Vishwamrita humbly replied, "I am already fully satisfied with your kind reception. I ask only for your permission to leave." Vasishta, however, repeatedly insisted that Vishwamrita and his men remain. Finally, Vishwamrita relented. This being settled, Vasishta brought his Kamandenu cow named Subala before Vishwamrita and ordered her to produce a sumptuous royal feast. Being so commanded, the celestial cow immediately brought forth a huge quantity of seemingly unlimited varieties of food and drink, all arranged on sparkling silver platters. Vishwamrita and his men then feasted to their full satisfaction. However, before long, Vishwamrita began to feel envious of Vasishta, wishing he had the celestial cow for himself. As the pangs of greed surfaced, Vishwamrita told Vasishta, "I must have this wonderful cow of yours at all costs. Please give her to me, and I will reward you appropriately." Vishwamrita offered the sage hundreds of thousands of cows, gold, unlimited jewels, and more. Regardless, Vasishta refused to give up his celestial cow, saying, "I am very sorry, but I shall never be able to part with this Kamandenu, even in exchange for 1 billion cows. This wish-fulfilling cow is inseparable from me, for I need her to supply all the ingredients for my sacrificial performances." Vishwamrita then replied, "This cow should rightfully belong to me, for the king is meant to possess the very best of everything." Because Vasishta's refusal only fanned the flames of Vishwamrita's desire, the king proceeded to offer the sage more and more. Regardless, Vasishta refused to part with his cow. Finally, out of frustration and anger, Vishwamrita grabbed the cow and began dragging her out of the ashram. At this, the Kamandenu cried out pitifully, imploring Vasishta, "O Rishi, why are you allowing me to be taken away like this? Although I have served you faithfully, are you now going to desert me?" Subala freed herself from the hundreds of men assisting Vishwamrita in dragging her away. As she fled back to the ashrama, Vasishta replied, "My dear Subala, I am certainly not abandoning you. However, my power is not equal to the king's. I am helpless to rescue you." Subala replied, "Dear Rishi, the king's material strength is insignificant in comparison to your spiritual strength. If you allow me to do so, I will utilize your superior energy to vanquish Vishwamrita's army myself." When Vasishta gave his consent, Subala proceeded to create innumerable fierce warriors from her body that began to consume Vishwamrita's army. However, the powerful king destroyed them all. Moreover, his Kshatriya spirit bristling, he challenged Subala to create more soldiers if she desired to continue fighting. Subala then proceeded to produce more, fiercer warriors that sprang from her udders, genitals, anus, and other bodily parts. These superior soldiers completely vanquished Vishwamrita's army. Seeing this, Vishwamrita's 100 sons angrily rushed at Vasishta, but the Brahmarshi reduced them to a mere pile of ashes simply by uttering a mighty roar. Having thus lost not only his entire army, but his sons as well, Vishwamrita departed, pale and dejected. Vishwamrita ordered his only remaining son to rule the kingdom and retired to the forest to perform austerities, hoping to please Lord Shiva. After some time, Lord Shiva became satisfied with Vishwamrita's austerities and appeared before the king to reward him. The delighted Vishwamrita expressed his desire to possess the knowledge of all celestial weapons. Lord Shiva known as Ashutosh, because he is easily pleased, awarded Vishwamrita his desired benediction. Thus Vishwamrita, who was already too proud, became exceedingly puffed up after receiving the celestial weapons, thinking his prowess to be invincible. Vishwamrita went directly to the ashrama of Vasishtha and began showering down his weapons so fiercely that it appeared the ashrama was on the verge of annihilation. All the sages residing there began to flee in terror, despite Vasishtha's assurances. Indeed, in a short time, the area appeared desolate. Picking up his brahminical rod, Vasishtha addressed Vishwamrita as follows: "Because of your rash act of aggression, I shall now cut down your false pride and show you the futility of your so-called prowess." Vasishtha held out his brahminical rod and neutralized all of Vasishtha's weapons. All of Vishwamrita's weapons. Vishwamrita then resorted to hurling his remaining celestial weapons. When this too failed, he prepared to release the ultimate weapon, the Brahmastra. From above, the demigods witnessed the spectacular duel. Well, when Vishwamrita invoked the terrible Brahmastra, they became wonderstruck and fearful. However, after Vishwamrita released the Brahmastra, Vasishtha countered it by assuming an awful form of gigantic proportions with flames blazing forth from every pore of his body, neutralizing the energy of the Brahmastra. The tremendous form exhibited by Vasishtha stunned everyone who witnessed it. Indeed, after seeing the Rishi's great prowess, the sages began to offer Vasishtha prayers. With the Brahmastra weapon countered, Vasishtha again assumed his normal form. In the meantime, Vishwamrita desisted from battle and departed, condemning the meager powers of the Kshatriyas. Understanding brahminical power to be superior, Vishwamrita became determined to become a Brahmarshi like Vasishtha. He then went into seclusion with his wife and began to execute severe austerities. After 1,000 years, Lord Brahma appeared before Vishwamrita and formally conferred upon him the status of Rajarshi as a reward. However, as Lord Brahma departed, Vishwamrita hung his head in shame over the meagerness of his achievement. Remaining determined to achieve the status of Brahmarshi and nothing less, Vishwamrita again resumed his severe austerities. He was only given the status of Rajarshi, but he wanted to become a Brahmarshi. During this same time, there was a king in the line of Ikshvaku named Trishanku, who ruled from his capital Ayodhya. Desiring to perform a sacrifice that would enable him to ascend to heaven in his human body without changing bodies, he requested Vasishtha to become his priest. Vasishtha, however, refused, claiming it would be impossible to perform such a sacrifice. Afterward, Trishanku approached Vasishtha's 100 sons, who were engaged in performing sacrifices, and asked them to assist him in the performance of his sacrifice. However, when they learned of their father's refusal, they angrily chastised him for attempting to solicit their help after being turned down by his guru. Hearing their criticism, Trishanku replied, "If you are not willing to help me, I will seek the assistance of others more magnanimous." Upon hearing Trishanku's impudent statement, the rishis became furious and cursed Trishanku to become a chandal. Soon thereafter, Trishanku's golden complexion turned black. His garments became old and soiled. His long, lustrous hair began to fall out. His cosmetics turned to ashes. His gold ornaments turned to iron, and his garland transformed into flowers from a crematorium. When Trishanku's ministers witnessed this transformation, they immediately abandoned him as untouchable. Having become a chandala, bereft of his former position, Trishanku went to see Vishwamrita, who was engaged in performing austerities. Vishwamrita welcomed Trishanku with compassion, hearing from him how he had been cursed by the sons of Vasishtha. When Trishanku begged Vishwamrita for help, the rishi assured him of shelter and promised to provide him with priests that would assist him in the performance of his sacrifice. Thereafter, Vishwamrita ordered his sons to petition all the priests and qualified brahmanas to assist him, asking also for the names of those who refused. Thus many brahmanas from kingdoms across the earth came to his ashrama. Only Vasishtha and his sons and the rishi Mahadaya refused to participate, saying, "What brahman or demigod would be willing to accept an offering from the hands of a kshatriya, what to speak of a chandala?" When Vishwamrita heard these harsh and insulting words, he immediately uttered the following curse: "May the wretched sons of Vasishtha be reduced to ashes and sent to the abode of Yamaraj this very day. Thereafter, let them take 700 births as chandalas, and may that fool Mahadaya become a nishada." The curses quickly took effect, and Vishwamrita was able to perceive the results by dint of his mystic vision. Vishwamrita then requested the brahmanas present to perform Trishanku's sacrifice. Simply out of fear of being cursed, they complied and started the sacrifice. When Vishwamrita invited the demigods to attend and accept their share of the offerings, they desisted. This made Vishwamrita very angry, and he declared to Trishanku that he would elevate him to heaven by his own prowess. Indeed, as soon as Vishwamrita made this vow, Trishanku began rising to heaven in his self-same body. When King Indra saw Trishanku approaching heaven without having earned sufficient pious merit, and after having disobeyed his guru, Vasishtha, Indra forced Trishanku to fall headfirst back toward earth. While thus falling, Trishanku called out helplessly to Vishwamrita to rescue him. Vishwamrita not only stopped Trishanku's fall, but also created a replica planetary system complete with imitation demigods for Trishanku to reside in. The demigods, however, were outraged by this wonderful feat. Approaching Vishwamrita, they said, "Give up your efforts to help Trishanku. He lacks the necessary qualifications for residing in the heavenly planets." Vishwamrita, however, insisted on keeping his promise. He declared, "I will never go back on my promise to send Trishanku to the heavenly planets without a change of body. Therefore, let it be ordained that my newly created heaven be accepted by you and remain for the duration of the universe." In the end, the demigods relented, and thus Trishanku remained head downwards in space. By the mercy of Vishwamrita, he enjoys heavenly bliss while shining brightly among the stars. Vishwamrita then returned to executing austerities, determined to become a brahmarshi like Vasishtha. Then after a long time had passed, a beautiful apsara named Menaka came to bathe at the Pushkar lake where Vishwamrita was conducting his austerities. Seeing her, Vishwamrita became overwhelmed with lust. Eager to enjoy sex, Vishwamrita implored her to remain with him in his ashrama. Menaka happily consented, and thus they passed 10 years together, enjoying each other while lost to the pleasures of sensual enjoyment. Finally, Vishwamrita came to his senses and felt great disgust. He thought to himself, "I have foolishly wasted 10 years merged in the so-called enjoyment of sense gratification. Now I can understand that Menaka was sent here by the demigods simply to steal my accumulated ascetic merit. By becoming a slave to lust, I have neglected my austerities. Thus, I have fallen down from my exalted position." Vishwamrita dismissed the fearful Menaka and then went to the northern side of the Himalayas, determined to remain celibate from then on. When Vishwamrita again resumed his austerities, the demigods grew increasingly fearful and approached Lord Brahma, begging him to award Vishwamrita the status of Maharishi. Lord Brahma agreed, but when he appeared before Vishwamrita, Vishwamrita replied that he would not be satisfied with anything less than the status of a Maharishi. Again, he had been offered Maharishi, but he wanted to be a Brahmarshi. Thus, Lord Brahma explained, "You have not yet fully controlled your senses. Therefore, you will have to practice more austerities before achieving your desired goal." After Lord Brahma departed, Vishwamrita resumed his austerities, standing with arms upraised and subsisting on air alone for 1,000 years. Thus Indra and the other demigods again became fearful and devised yet another plan to thwart Vishwamrita. Indra requested the lovely apsara named Ramba to allure Vishwamrita away from his practice of austerities. Ramba, trembling with fear, declined, saying that she feared Vishwamrita's curse. Indra, however, assured her by saying, "Dear girl, please do not be afraid, for you shall surely succeed. It is springtime and Cupid shall accompany you. I shall also go, disguised as a sweet singing cuckoo. Do not worry. Your beauty is irresistible. Vishwamrita will become a toy in your hands." Ramba finally agreed, and thereafter she appeared before Vishwamrita in a most pleasing manner, displaying her various feminine allurements. At first, Vishwamrita was pleased to see her, thinking she had come of her own accord. However, after a moment's consideration, Vishwamrita realized that her appearance was simply another trick to thwart him from his practice. Flaring with anger, Vishwamrita roared, "You foolish woman! You knew I was performing austerities for the performance of controlling my senses. Still, you dare to persist, trying to seduce me. For this, you will have to stand as a stone statue for 10,000 years, or until the Rishi Vasishta delivers you." Ramba immediately turned into stone, while Indra and Cupid fearfully fled from the scene. However, after cursing the apsara, Vishwamrita became morose, realizing that he had fallen victim to uncontrolled anger, thus diminishing his accumulated stock of ascetic merit. Vishwamrita then vowed to never again become angry. "I will not breathe, utter a word, or eat a morsel of food or drink until I have achieved the status of Brahmarshi." Vishwamrita then resumed his austerities. However, after fasting for 1,000 years, he decided to eat something. Just as Vishwamrita was about to take his first bite, King Indra appeared before him in the dress of a brahmana and begged for all his food. Without remorse or anger, Vishwamrita humbly gave all he had planned to eat to the brahmana and went back to performing his austerities for another 1,000 years. Vishwamrita's powerful austerities began to heat up the entire universe, and smoke began to emanate from his head. Feeling great distress, the demigods again approached Lord Brahma to appease Vishwamrita. At that time, Lord Brahma, along with the demigods, went to Vishwamrita and awarded him the status of Brahmarshi, just to persuade him to desist in his austerities. Vishwamrita became very satisfied at heart. However, he further insisted, "It is not enough for you to award me the status of Brahmarshi. I must be accepted as such by the other Brahmarshis, especially Vasishta." Thus, at the request of the demigods, Vasishta went to Vishwamrita and agreed to recognize him as a Brahmarshi. In turn, Vishwamrita also offered great respect to Vasishta. Their long-standing enmity was soon forgotten, and they became friends. The next morning, Maharaj Janak called for Vishwamrita, Rama, and Lakshman. After respectfully greeting them, he said, "I know that such great personalities would not come here without some grave purpose. Therefore, please inform me what service I may offer you." Vishwamrita smilingly replied, "Rama and Lakshman have come here because they are eager to see the wonderful bow you keep and have worshipped for so long." Maharaj Janak then explained, "This bow was used by Lord Shiva in a bygone age to disrupt the sacrifice of his father-in-law, Daksha. Being denied his sacrificial share, Lord Shiva angrily picked up his bow and threatened to annihilate the demigods. Coming to their senses, the demigods were able to pacify Lord Shiva. In turn, he handed over his bow to them. The demigods later entrusted the bow to Devavrata, the descendant of Maharaj Nimi, my forefather." After describing the history of Lord Shiva's bow, Maharaj Janak then related another interesting story. "Once upon a time, as I was leveling the sacrificial arena with a golden plow, much to my astonishment, I happened to uncover a baby girl. I named her Sita Furo and raised her as my own daughter. Sita quickly grew up, and when she attained maturity, many eligible princes came calling, hoping to win her hand in marriage. Since my daughter was not an ordinary being, I explained to the princes that to win her hand in marriage, they must possess great valor. Then I brought forth the bow of Lord Shiva and asked them to string it. However, none could even lift or hold it, what to speak of bending or stringing it. Most of the princes left, feeling insulted, and they banded together to attack Mithila. A fierce battle raged for 12 months. Finally, as my army weakened, I prayed to the demigods for assistance. In answer to my plea, the celestials mercifully sent an army, and simply by seeing them, my enemies fled in fear. Since Rama is eager to see the bow of Lord Shiva, I will bring it before him to examine. If Rama is able to string this wonderful bow, then I will gladly give him my beautiful daughter Sita. Soon 500 strong men pulled the immense bow, which was encased in a chest, and mounted it on a cart with 8 wheels. Vishwamrita invited Ram to open the chest while thousands of people gathered to watch. As Ram gazed with admiration at the bow, Maharaj Janak warned, "Even great demigods, demons, rakshasas, yakshas, gandharvas, and nagas have failed to even bend this mighty bow. How then will a mere mortal succeed in stringing it?" Nevertheless, Rama sportingly placed his left hand upon the middle of the bow. Then in the presence of the huge crowd, he effortlessly lifted the bow out of its case. Holding the bow aloft, Rama strung the bow in an instant, and bending it with great force, he snapped it in the middle, just as a baby elephant breaks a stick of sugar cane. The thunderous cracking sound produced was like a mountain bursting apart and caused all but Vishwamrita, Janak, Ram, and Lakshman to fall to the ground. Thus, with great pleasure, Maharaj Janak requested Vishwamrita to send messengers to Ayodhya, inviting King Dasharath to attend the marriage of Ram and Sita. When the messengers arrived 3 days later at the court of Maharaj Dasharath, they related the glorious events of Ram's breaking the bow and winning Sita's hand in marriage. Hearing this, Maharaj Dasharath became overjoyed. Then, after consulting with Vasishta and Vamandev, Maharaj Dasharath decided that they should all depart from Mithila the following day. The next morning, Maharaj Dasharath started out, keeping his family priest in front and taking his army and a quantity of wealth. After traveling for 4 days, the party reached the outskirts of Mithila. Seeing his approach, King Janak came out to meet Maharaj Dasharath, giving him a royal reception. Afterward, when Maharaj Dasharath had met his sons, it was fixed that the preliminary marriage rituals would begin at an auspicious moment the next day. The next morning, everyone assembled, and before the wedding ceremonies commenced, Maharaj Dasharath requested King Janak to hear of his royal lineage from Vasishta. Being so requested, the great sage Vasishta narrated the history of the Raghu dynasty. Marichi was the direct son of Lord Brahma, and Marichi's son was Kashyapa. From Kashyapa was born Vivaswan, the sun god, and Vivaswan's son was Manu. The son of Vaivaswata Manu was Ikshvaku, who was the first ruler of Ayodhya. Many generations later, in the Ikshvaku line came Bharata, whose son Asita was conquered by his enemies, the Haihayas, Talajangas, and Shashabindus. Being defeated, Asita decided to retire to the Mahalayas along with his two wives. When Asita passed away, one of the widows named Kalindi was pregnant. The other widow became envious of her and mixed poison in with Kalindi's food, desiring to kill the child within her womb. When Kalindi began to suffer the effects of the poison, the great rishi, Chayavana, happened to arrive at that spot. Kalindi tearfully sought his blessings so that her child might live. The rishi assured her that a son would be born, along with the excreted poison. Because of these unusual circumstances, Kalindi's son was named Sagara, or one who is born along with poison. Later on, in the line of Ikshvaku, the great grandson of Maharaj Bhagirath, named Pravrita, was cursed by Vasishtha to become a Rakshasa. And thus he came to be known as Kalmashapat. There were many great kings who descended from Ikshvaku, such as Ambarish, Nahusha, Yayati, Nabhaga, and Uja, the father of Maharaj Dasharath. After describing their histories as well as many others, Vasishtha formally requested King Janak to give away his two daughters, Sita and Urmila, in charity to Rama and Lakshman. Janak Maharaj then described his own genealogy, beginning with King Nimi and concluding with his own father, Hrasvaroma. The king then happily concluded the solemn agreement, giving away his daughters to the sons of Maharaj Dasharath. First, Janak requested Dasharath to have the Samavartana ceremony performed for Ram and Lakshman. This entails shaving the head and underarms when a student returns home from the Gurukula. Then the fire sacrifice was fixed for 3 days later at an auspicious time. Vasishtha requested that the two daughters of King Janak's younger brother, Kushadwaj, be given in charity to Bharat and Shatrughna. Janak agreed, and when the Samavartana ceremony was performed, Maharaj Dasharath gave away 100,000 cows in charity to the Brahmanas for each of his four sons. Thereafter, at the auspicious hour known as Vijaya, on the day chosen for the marriage, Vasishtha approached Maharaj Janak and said, "O king, the ruler of Kosala and his four sons wait outside for he who shall give away his daughters. Let the auspicious wedding sacrifice now begin without delay." Thereafter, Maharaj Dasharath escorted his four sons into the sacrificial arena while Vasishtha Muni prepared the sacred altar, decorating it with sandalwood paste, flowers, potted plants, bowls filled with scented water, grains, incense, and pots of turmeric, along with auspicious articles. Then, when all was ready, Vasishtha lit the sacrificial fire and began offering oblations while the other brahmanas chanted Vedic mantras. King Janak then escorted Sita into the sacrificial arena and seated her next to Ram. With a voice trembling with emotion, Janak said, "O noble prince, this is my daughter Sita. Please take her hand and accept her as your lifelong partner. She is a reservoir of all auspicious qualities, and she will forever be devoted to you as faithfully as your own shadow." Then the Gandharvas sang, and the Apsaras danced with joy, amid showers of flowers from heaven and the vibration of celestial drums. King Janak joined the hand of the goddess of fortune Sita with the hand of the Supreme Lord Rama. Then King Janak placed the hand of Urmila into Lakshmana's hand, then Madhavi's hand in Bharat's, and finally Shutakirti's hand into Shatrughna's. The four brothers then circumambulated the sacrificial fire three times while clasping the hands of their newly wedded wives. Afterwards, they circumambulated King Janak and the great rishis. Upon gaining Sita, the embodiment of all loveliness and virtue, Ram felt unlimited satisfaction and happiness. Similarly, Sita felt unprecedented bliss upon achieving her beloved Ram, the lord of her heart, and the emblem of goddess of goodness, chivalry, intelligence, and handsomeness. Sita and Ram were equally endowed with transcendental qualities of form, beauty, behavior, age, and nature. Dedicating their hearts to each other, Sita and Ram shone resplendently, just as Lord Vishnu shines in the company of his divine consort, Lakshmi. Even today, opulent marriage festivals are enjoyed universally. The Supreme Lord Ram himself has kindly shown us that a man and woman can enjoy a successful marriage by combining to follow religious principles. Human beings should not mate simply out of sex impulse like cats and dogs. For the way of the beast is characterized by fear, suffering, and rebirth. Therefore, every civilized society has some systematic arrangement for married life according to religious codes aimed at bringing peace and in the peace, and in the best of societies, Krishna-conscious living. Eternally related as husband and wife, Ram and Sita are inseparable. Materialists sometimes want to worship and possess the goddess of fortune without Lord Ram, but this is never possible. Without Ram, Sita turns into Durga, the material energy personified, and to embrace her is to embrace death. However, if we concentrate on pleasing Lord Ram or Lord Krishna, the goddess of fortune will automatically bestow all her blessings upon us. The secret of successful living, including family affairs, is to put the Lord in the center of our lives and make his service the goal of our endeavors. After the day's festivities were concluded, the marriage party retired for the night. The next morning, Vishwamrita left Mathila for the Himalayas, and later that day, Maharaj Dasharath departed with his four sons and their wives after receiving a large dowry from King Janak. On the way back to Ayodhya, Maharaj Dasharath observed the inauspicious sign of numerous fearful birds screeching overhead. At the same time, he saw the auspicious sign of deer crossing his path from left to right. Fearing some impending danger, the king inquired from Vasishtha for an explanation. The Rishi replied, "The screaming birds indicate some imminent danger. However, the deer crossing from left to right indicate there's no need to worry on that account." While Maharaj Dasharath and his priest were thus discussing the matter, a fierce wind began blowing, shaking the very earth and knocking down many tall trees. Dust rose up and began to cover everything from all directions. It became so dark that nearly everyone except Maharaj Dasharath, his sons and Vasishtha, and the other rishis became bewildered and panic-stricken. Suddenly the famous and terrible warrior Parashuram appeared with matted hair, an axe on his right shoulder, and a bow on his left, and a powerful arrow in his hands. The rishis were supposed to see Parashuram in this ferocious aspect. The rishis were surprised to see Parashuram in this ferocious aspect, since previously, after annihilating the Kshatriya community 21 times, he had vowed to give up his anger and remain fixed in the execution of austerities. As the rishis were wondering why he had again become moved to anger, the son of Jamadagni addressed Lord Rama as follows: "You have certainly performed a heroic feat by breaking the bow of Lord Shiva. However, I am carrying an even greater bow, that of Lord Vishnu. If you consider yourself a great hero, then take this bow and string it. If you are able to draw the arrow back to its full length, then I shall consider you a fit person to fight with." Hearing Parashuram's challenge, Maharaj Dasharath became overwhelmed with grief, afraid to lose his beloved son. With a trembling voice, the king pleaded, "O best of the rishis, Parashuram, please desist from your aggressive spirit. I beg to remind you of your vow to give up fighting. After handing over the earth to Kashyapa, you retired to Mount Mahendra to perform austerities." Parashuram, however, ignored Dasharath and continued to address Ram, saying, "Both Lord Shiva's bow and this bow of Lord Vishnu were constructed by Vishwakarma. Lord Shiva was given one of the bows to kill Triparasura. One day, after Lord Shiva killed the demon, the demigods went to Lord Brahma and curiously inquired, 'Who is more powerful, Lord Shiva or Lord Vishnu?' To resolve their doubt, Lord Brahma arranged to create some conflict between the two. As a result, a fierce battle ensued. During the fight, Lord Vishnu cut off Lord Shiva's bowstring and then, simply by releasing a lenses, at the behest of the demigods, the fighting was then stopped. Everyone who witnessed the duel concluded that Lord Vishnu is superior to Lord Shiva in all respects. Lord Shiva, however, felt bitter because of his defeat and was insulted by the verdict of the demigods. Thus, in gloom and disgust, he gave away the bow to Devavrata, a king in the line of Ikshvaku. Lord Vishnu gave away his bow to the great sage Rishika, who later gave it to his son Jamadagni. However, my father never used that bow, for he had vowed not to retaliate against any wrong done to him. Thereafter I received the bow from him, and after killing the Kshatriyas 21 times as a revenge for Kartavirya Arjuna slaying my father, I became the sole ruler of the earth. When Kashyapa performed a great sacrifice so that I could make atonement for killing the Kshatriyas, I gave him the earth as his priestly reward and then retired to Mount Mahendra. While there, I required great prowess by performing severe austerities. However, when I heard that you had broken the bow of Lord Shiva, I felt compelled to come and challenge you. If you consider yourself a great hero, then take this bow and see if you are worthy of fighting with me. Without speaking, Rama accepted Parashuram's challenge by quickly snatching his bow and arrow from his hands and took with it his long-acquired ascetic prowess. Then, after effortlessly stringing the bow before the awestruck Parashuram, Ram drew the arrow back to its full length. Ram then declared, "Because you are a Brahmana and related to Vishramrita, I shall not slay you. However, so that my taking up this arrow may not go in vain and your challenge may be properly answered, I will use it to destroy the attainment of heaven which you earned as a result of your penances." The demigods and celestial rishis assembled in the sky to witness Ram's shooting of the arrow. Parashuram had already been rendered impotent by Ram, and all he could do was gaze at the Lord with wide-open eyes. Finally, as Ram continued to keep the arrow pulled back to his ear, Parashuram said in a subdued voice, "After I gave away the earth to Kashyapa, he ordered me not to reside here again. For this reason, I must leave before night falls. Although my access to heaven has been taken away, I beg you to at least allow me to return to Mount Mahendra so that I may continue my austerities. O Ram, I can now understand that you are Lord Vishnu himself. Thus I am not ashamed at having met defeat at your hands." Ram silently accepted Parashuram's request and then released the mighty arrow, thus destroying the son of Jamadagni's eligibility for heavenly elevation. Thereafter, Parashuram returned to Mount Mahendra. As soon as he departed, the darkness previously created completely dissipated. From their position in the sky, the demigods glorified Lord Ram with great enthusiasm and showered him with fragrant flowers. Lord Ram then presented the bow of Lord Vishnu to Varuna, and the party thus continued on its way. Upon returning home, the four sons of Maharaj Dashrath began living happily with their wives. After some time, King Yudhajit, the son of Kekai, and a maternal uncle of Bharat and Shatrughna came to Ayodhya and invited his nephews to come and stay with him. After his two brothers departed for the Kekai kingdom, Ram began serving his father and three mothers with great care. Ram also carried out the state administrative functions so honestly and conscientiously that all the citizens came to love him dearly. Sita and Ram's natural attachment for each other grew day by day. They became completely dedicated to one another, being bound by each other's beauty and good qualities. In truth, Sita was beauty incarnate, being the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi herself. Within her mind, Sita could vividly read everything in the innermost core of Ram's heart. Being always determined to please her husband and acting as the emblem of womanly gentleness and chastity, Sita was soon able to bring the heart of Lord Ram under her control. Thus ends the first chapter of the summary study of Ramayana by His Holiness Bhaktivikas Swami. And thus ends tonight's reading of the Sri Ramayana. We thank everyone who joined us online tonight and heard this narration. Just by hearing of the Lord's pastimes, one becomes immediately sanctified and eligible for more hearing and chanting, which is the goal of life, to hear about the Lord. Thank you very much, everyone. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bo. Nacharyan Marman.
Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.